I tend to find that the most interesting parts of these sessions are the question and answers and discussion. But having said that, you know, there's also, I think, a certain amount of worth in trying to present some of the background on Syria. And that's what I'm going to do now for, I guess, something like 20, 25 minutes, after which we'll have plenty of time for questions, discussion, comments, and so on. What I want to do then is, in essence, three things. I'd like to look at the current situation in Syria with a little bit of background as to how we got to where we currently are with regard to the situation in that country. I'd like to attempt some speculation regarding the chances for Assad regime survival, or conversely a successful toppling of the regime. And finally, I'd like to, and perhaps most importantly, I would like to try to place the Syrian issue in the context of broader regional development and the broader regional strategic situation. And then, just for fun at the end, I'd like to offer some tentative recommendations, knowing full well that my recommendations tend to disappear as quickly as they are suggested. But there we are. Regarding the current state of events, it's clear that the Assad regime was caught badly unawares by the outbreak of large-scale protests in Syria 3 months ago. Those of you who followed these affairs closely will be familiar with the extremely unfortunate interview that Assad gave to the Wall Street Journal just days before the uprising in Syria began, in which he said, in Syria you won't see anything like this. In Syria it's not going to happen. Because why? The interviewer asked. And Assad said, because in Syria, the regime is in tune with the people. In Syria, the regime shares the people's ideas and ideology. Well, 3 days later, a revolt broke out against the Assad regime, and the Assad regime was caught unawares. And for the first couple of weeks, the regime was flailing. It was clear that Assad had not expected this. It was clear he didn't quite know what to do. So you had this weird combination of, on the one hand, some kind of ham-fisted attempts at reform, and on the other hand, an increasingly hard hand against the protesters. Those of you who are getting followed closely, you'll remember that the sacking of the governor of Deraa, a man called Faisal Khaltoum, was the first move in attempting to placate the process, which began in Deraa, in the south of the country. Then we had the granting of nationality to thousands of Syrian Kurds who'd been denied nationality. This, by the way, is one of the most scandalous aspects of modern Middle Eastern politics, hardly ever written about in the mainstream media, of course, that there are, in fact, 200,000 Syrian-born Kurds, born in Syria, who are simply denied their citizenship of Syria. They can't come out of the country, they simply don't have citizenship rights. And a number of other small cosmetic concessions made, culminating in the notional withdrawal of Syria's emergency laws, you'll remember, in mid-April. And again, with the wonderful irony which Syria sometimes shows us, on the one day the emergency laws are withdrawn, and the next day 40 people are killed by the regime's armed forces as it tries to put down continued protests. From mid-April, the pretense at reform ends, and the Assad regime goes more or less openly to war against its own people. From then on, it's no further nice words, just force. The demonstrations spread from Daraa to Latakia and Banias on the coast, to Homs in central Syria, to Douma, a suburb of Damascus, to the Kurdish cities. But they spread slowly, and they remained of limited size. And they remain of limited size. It's clear that one of the reasons for this is simply because of the very great capacity for terror and for terrorizing which the regime has. It's just too frightening and too worrying for many people to risk going onto the streets against the Assad regime. And so, and unlike in Egypt, unlike in Tunisia, in Syria, the protests have stayed relatively small. Around 1,000 people are now dead. Thousands of refugees have left Syria for Lebanon. The Syrian armed forces, having first placed areas in revolt under closure and siege, are now moving in to pacify them. Armor and artillery shells are being used against civilian dwelling areas, and against civilian crowds. The regime has been moving from town to town using these tactics of pacification, from Deraa, again, where in the south, where the uprising began, and to Homs and to Banias, first surrounding and then going in for the kill. And of course, we are not hearing about it because the regime also, as you are all aware, has closed down the country to foreign media coverage. It's a little bit too risky now for a foreign journalist to risk going into Syria. Allow me to be cynical in this company at least and say it's much easier to be a hero against the Israeli border police on the checkpoint outside Nablus than it is against the Syrian Presidential Guard of 4th Armored Division. And the journalists know that. This then is the point where things currently stand. The demonstrations have stayed small. The regime is in a state of open repression, no longer pretends for reform, war against its own people. What of the international response so far to this situation? The response has been, to put it politely, tepid. The United States, of course, has had sanctions against Syria since 2007. And it has imposed a number of quite small new sanctions against the Syrian intelligence agency and against a number of officials of the Syrian regime. The European Union later on also has imposed sanctions against 13 regime officials and an arms embargo in addition. Neither of these packages of sanctions are directed against President Bashar Assad himself. That is to say, the strange illusion is maintained whereby in this very tightly organized dictatorship, it is assumed that somehow the President Assad doesn't control what's going on in his own country. Mrs. Bustayna Shaaban, a close advisor to President Assad, treated these sanctions with disdain and amusement in a recent interview she granted to Anthony Shadid of the New York Times. It has to be said that in this instance, at least, Mrs. Bustayna Shaaban was probably correct. These sanctions are simply gestures. The demonstrations are continuing and they show no signs of running out of steam. But they also show no sign as yet of making Syria ungovernable. They just haven't reached that volume yet. So for as long as the unrest continues on this level, the regime's survival is hardly in question. One mechanism which could be a game changer would be a split in the Syrian armed forces. So let me examine for a moment, on the basis of what I'm hearing from my own contacts in the Syrian opposition and elsewhere, whether there is any evidence of this or any serious hope of this. Well, in the early part of the protests, there were reports, some of you will remember in the media from the south of Syria, of a largely Sunni division, the 5th Division of the Syrian Army, clashing with the overwhelmingly Alawi 4th Armored Division, which has been a key tool in the protest, in the repression of the protests. The fact of the matter is that since those reports, there has been very little additional evidence of widespread mutiny. The bodies of 80 soldiers were reportedly discovered in the southern part of the country outside Deraa, indicating that the regime itself is taking an extremely uncompromisingly brutal and cruel approach to any signs of mutiny amongst troops. There's no hesitation whatsoever about shooting its own soldiers if they begin to give indications of disobeying orders. And it may well be that this in itself is serving to keep the conscripts in the Syrian army in line. It's worth remembering also just what a locked down and policed state Syria actually is. The country has 4 security directorates, which together employ a total of 65,000 full-time employees. One can assume that this can be quadrupled or multiplied further if one considers the amount of non-directly employed informers and agents who are involved with this with these organizations. These security and intelligence organizations are well paid, they are well cared for, they are unlikely to defect, and they are engaged currently most busily in the prevention of any signs of mutiny in the army, because they understand very well, as we understand too, that this could be the crucial game changer. If Bashar starts to lose his security forces, he loses the tool that keeps him in power. The regime has no longer any pretense of legitimacy. It couldn't really care less anymore what its own people think of it. But it needs to keep the instruments of repression. Right now, it appears to be doing so. The 4th Armored Division, which we mentioned earlier, a well-financed, well-equipped division consisting almost entirely of Alawi Syrians, Syrians belonging to the same religious sect as the Athas themselves, is playing a crucial role in suppressing the protests. Brutal measures against other units seem to be set to prevent further splits. So the hope that the army would split and get us out of this situation does not look likely at the present time. What about the other side? What about the Syrian opposition? First of all, it is important to note that it is extremely difficult to trace a coherent leadership on the part of the Syrian opposition within Syria of any kind. We just don't quite know who's actually leading these guys. There is a fractured external opposition fractured throughout various parts of the world. There is the National Salvation Front of former Syrian Vice President Abdel Halim Khaddam, if some of you are perhaps familiar to some of the people around this table. There is the Movement for Justice and Development, which is the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria, based in London. There is, of course, the Reform Party, the Syrian Reform Party of Farid Ghadri, based in Washington. It's important for me to name check those organizations. We can pretty much leave the discussion about them there, because they are not, any of them, engaged in or leading in the protests currently taking place in Syria. Some of the signatories of the 2005 Damascus Declaration, by contrast, do appear to be involved in the protests, and they appear to have drawn towards them some of the young campaigners who began these protests. But again, it is impossible at the present time to come up with a clear structure of command so that you can say, okay, here's the guys who are running this, here's who we need to talk to, here's what they believe in, are they Islamist, aren't they Islamist? Right now, it's just not possible to say. There is an absolutely amorphous reality right now in Syria. With regard to the crucial issue of Islamist involvement in the protests, let me say the following. First of all, the version of events that the Syrian regime is trying to sell to the world is that it is facing a revolt by Islamist organizations. That's the story that Assad wants to tell the world, for obvious reasons, because he wants it to be understood that you might not like me very much, Assad that is, but the guys who are against me, you like them even less. Yeah? Now, there is some evidence of Islamist involvement in the protests. The Muslim Brotherhood undoubtedly exists in the country, but the fact of the matter is that the Muslim Brotherhood was absolutely decimated in the early 1980s by Assad the Father, when they rose up against him. And all of us here have heard of the massacre of Alhama in 1982. It was only the culmination of this repression. And they have found it very, very hard to get organized again within the country. There is an article in the Syrian law whereby membership of the Muslim Brotherhood is a crime punishable by death in Syria. And the regime has no hesitation in using this article. And it means that the Muslim Brothers, unlike in Egypt, do not constitute a kind of ready-made alternative government, whereby as soon as the government leaves, you've got this sort of existing structure like you have in Egypt. You don't have that in Syria. This is first of all, and it's important. Second of all, with regard to the more extreme Salafi elements, again, everyone here, I presume, is familiar with this term, the Al-Qaeda type stream. Also, they exist in Syria. The regime is keen to point out that they are engaged in the protests. But the fact of the matter is that for those of us who work regularly on Syria and follow it closely, we know that one of the tools that the Syrian regime has employed in the past, also in Syria itself, and also neighboring Lebanon, has been these small Salafi organizations. The regime intelligence services find it quite easy to infiltrate these organizations and to turn them to do the work of the regime itself. So one should not be taken in by the notion that these Salafi organizations are necessarily independent or are necessarily working against the regime. They might look like they're working against the regime and at the same time be actually operating on behalf of the Syrian regime. Let me tell you that one of the problems of working on Syria is that whenever you meet a Syrian oppositionist, he or she will tell you, about half of the Syrian oppositionists that you will meet are in fact working for the regime. The problem is that he or she will never tell you which half. So you have a problem. It's a fact. You know, the Syrian opposition is well penetrated by the Syrian security services, and one has to treat anything coming out of those circles with an extra amount of caution. What about neighboring countries? Has there been any pressure from neighboring countries on the regime to reform? The answer is on the contrary, and it's interesting to note that the Arab states as a whole have been entirely silent. Interesting and not surprising to note, the Arab states as a whole have been entirely silent with regard to the unrest in Syria, with the exception of Jordan, which now has endorsed the regime and endorsed the regime's techniques. It's quite odd, because in the first days, the Syrian regime was trying to blame the Jordanians for being responsible for this uprising. But the Jordanians themselves have now openly come out in favor of the regime. The one exception in terms of regional states has been Turkey, which has played a more sophisticated role, not surprisingly. The Turks have very good and close relations, of course, with the Assad regime. They also have very good and close relations with the Islamic opposition in Syria and the Syrian opposition outside of the country. And so they are quite cleverly, I would say, playing both sides against the middle. The best way, of course, of not losing is by supporting both sides. And the Turks, Erdogan has been very critical of Assad, at the same time keeping relations with him, and at the same time maintaining good relations with the opposition. So, to sum up this first part, as things currently stand in Syria, the international response has been weak, the regime has dug in, the regime is engaging in acts of quite astonishing brutality and cruelty, unsurprisingly, to keep itself in power. As a consequence, the protests are continuing, but are growing in numbers only very slowly. The opposition is disunited, the regime has begun to crush centers of protest by extreme force, and the army has not begun to split. For as long as all these factors continue to apply, the Assad regime stands a very, very good chance indeed of coming through the current unrest. Indeed, this remains the most likely option. Bottom line from everything I've said in the last, whatever, 15 minutes, is that right now, the Bashar al-Assad regime looks like it is going to survive. It is not, does not currently look like it is going to go the way of Bin Ali in Tunisia, Mubarak in Egypt. It's going to survive. It looks like it's going to survive. What is the regional strategic implication of the events in Syria, and what would be the implication for a regional strategy of Assad's survival? Syria constitutes a key component of the pro-Iranian regional bloc, whose challenge to the US-led regional order in the Middle East remains the key and central strategic process taking place in our region, in the Middle East. It's important to underline that point. We were talking about this, Bob and I, earlier on, because certainly in media discussion or media coverage of the region, there's been a kind of sense given that because of this Arab Spring and these new uprisings against the regimes, all the old realities and assumptions about the region no longer apply. It's passé to talk about Islamism now, that's all finished. Anyway, Bin Laden is dead, and clearly once he's dead, no more Islamism, obviously, right? So the idea is that, you know, there's a whole new discussion and a need for a whole and comprehensive reshaping of all concepts with which we dealt with the region. This is fatally and dangerously incorrect. The fact of the matter is that the core strategic process of the region, namely the contest between an Iranian-led Islamist bloc on the one hand and the United States and its various allies in the region on the other, this core process remains in place. And the key question we have to ask ourselves with the Arab Spring is, what effect is the Arab Spring having on this process? Who's coming out of it on top? Who's coming out of it the loser? Who's looking strong as a result of the Arab Spring? Who's looking weaker? Well, with regard to Syria, we can see, as I'll now go on to try to demonstrate, just how important the Iranian alignment has been in enabling Assad to get on top of the protests. Syria's alignment with Iran and its backing of local paramilitary and terrorist clients, Hamas amongst the Palestinians, Hezbollah in Lebanon and so on, these relations are not flimsy marriages of convenience in the way that they've sometimes been portrayed. They were and are the core of a very successful Syrian regional policy. Through it, Damascus has magnified its local and regional influence, and it has obtained an insurance policy against paying any price for its activities. It is now clear that this policy made sense in other ways too. Indeed, it is clear that this policy, this insurance policy, so to speak, that Syria took out by making friends with Iran and with a variety of terrorist and paramilitary actors in the region, is currently paying dividends. Syria's alignment with the regional axis led by Iran represents Assad's best hope of survival, because Western hesitancy to confront Iran and its allies in the region is the crucial factor making possible the crackdown in Syria and hence the survival of the regime. How so? Well, let's look at the scorecard of the Arab Spring so far to understand how this mechanism works. The pro-Western Arab authoritarian rulers, Bin Ali of Tunisia and Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, were forced aside by a combination of internal and subsequently external Western pressure. Non-aligned, isolated Muammar Gaddafi of Libya now finds himself fighting against a coalition of local rebels and Western air power. Assad, by contrast, who by all objective measures is more brutal and more cruel and more anti-democratic than any of these, but who is also aligned with the coalition of anti-Western states and movements led by Iran, is currently facing, as we saw a moment ago, only tepid and nominal Western pressure. The US administration disapproves of the repression, but the US ambassador, the newly minted US ambassador to Syria, Robert Ford, remains firmly in place, no intention to bring him home. The sanctions, as mentioned, don't even target Bashar himself. Well, there has been much speculation regarding this softly approach to Bashar. By the way, inevitably, you can find circles who blame Israel for it. That won't surprise you, right? Now, how do we get to that? Well, because people say, well, actually, this is Israel lobbying. I'm in contact with Lebanese oppositionists, for example, who will say, Israel's doing this. It's your guys in Washington who are stopping the hard line against Bashar. And I say, how on earth do you get to that? And they say, well, because we all know that Bashar keeps the Golan Heights border quiet, and that therefore the Israelis have an interest in keeping him somehow in place, and therefore X, Y, and the rest of it. The common phrase used in the Middle East, we say, who benefits? So one of the ways is, who benefits? What it means is you can assert anything you want, and nobody's allowed to ask for any proof, because all you have to do is say, if I can work out a way in which this guy could benefit from this, that means that he must be doing it. It usually works with regard to Israel. There you go. It may well be that there are perennial illusions remaining regarding the potential future role of the Syrian regime in some notional future Arab-Israeli peace process. I suspect there are people also in this country, also in Israel itself, who still maintain those kinds of illusions. It's hard for me to believe that anybody still takes seriously the notion of Bashar Assad as a reformer. I have heard even that Senator John Kerry, miracle of miracles, that even Senator John Kerry no longer believes this. And he was amongst its most fervent and faithful proponents. So if he has abandoned the faith, I suspect that most of the other less fervent adherents also have done so.
What about the Secretary of State?
The Secretary of State. Well, she, even her statements have been slightly getting weaker, right? I mean, Bashar was a reformer 2 weeks ago, and now he still has the chance of embarking on a policy of reform. So we hope, you know, we believe with perfect faith, right, that eventually everybody, maybe, possibly, hopefully, can be cured of the Assad disease. Look, it seems to me that we can speculate about all this stuff, about the reformer issue, the Arab-Israeli issue, but let me reiterate. There is a more basic reason for the easy ride that Bashar is getting. And let me reiterate, it's that if you mess around with Assad, you are issuing a challenge to Iran, to Hezbollah, to Hamas, and to their various regional allies and interests in Iraq, possibly further afield too. Also in Afghanistan, if we think of the Iranian connection there. The leaders of the West just don't want to do that. They want a smooth withdrawal from Iraq and from Afghanistan in the years ahead. Syria is part of a club of countries and organizations which can affect if they're going to get one or not going to get one. It's good old protection racket style stuff, and it seems to be working. Now, Syrian and Iranian strategic partnership runs very deep. There's every reason to assume that the Iranians themselves have every wish and every interest in preserving it. There is a formal military treaty of military cooperation between Syria and Iran, which was signed in 1998. Syria gives Iran a presence on the Mediterranean, as some people here will know, this is a traditional Persian strategic goal going back to antiquity. Syria is the opening, so to speak, the gateway for the Iranians into the Arab world. It is the only Arab state currently aligned with Iran. And of course, Syria geographically serves as a conduit for the funneling of arms and material to Iran's main paramilitary ally, or paramilitary proxy, namely the Hezbollah organization in Lebanon. And so according to opposition reports coming out of Syria, unsurprisingly, Iran is playing a crucial, practical role in suppressing the uprising in Syria. Many Syrian oppositionists who I speak to believe that at least some of the snipers whose bullets are taking a terrible toll of civilian protesters are in fact Iranians. There have been reports of high-ranking officers of the Revolutionary Guards, of the Quds Force of Revolutionary Guards, being present in Damascus also, in Homs also, in Banias also, throughout the protest, helping both practically and in terms of training and in terms of equipment to make sure, so to speak, that the Arab Spring stops at the borders of the Iran-led regional alliance. The Iranians and their allies, of course, enthusiastically cheered the demonstrations in Egypt and Tunisia, but they have every interest in making sure that that the protests stop where their clients begin. The fall or weakening of the Assad regime in Syria would constitute a very, very serious body blow to Iranian regional ambitions. And conversely, the resurgence, the survival and resurgence of Assad under the protective tutelage of Iran will prove that membership of the Iranian alliance provides a handy guarantee for autocratic rulers facing the anger or opposition of their own peoples. It may well be that the Western media will prefer to ignore the power politics implications of that. You can assume that regional leaders will not do so. They will pay very close attention to this. It's therefore the case, it seems to me at least, that there is a direct Western interest in preventing that outcome. That is to say, if Assad survives and rebounds from these protests, it is to the benefit entirely of the West enemies and of the anti-Western bloc in the region. Any effort to bring Bashar down is going to be a marathon. It's not going to be a sprint. There's little or no likelihood of military action against him for reasons we are all aware of. But there are things that can be done that have not yet been done. At least the departure of Bashar could be defined as a goal by the United States and by the European Union. Amnesty for low-level or mid-level defectors could be ensured. Resources could be provided to the opposition. The freezing of assets of Bashar and his family. This is something which the Europeans should deal with, because most of the money's there, we are told. Yeah? But these kind of measures can be taken. Let me sum up and conclude, since I'd like us to move to questions in a moment, by saying the following then. Just really reiterating. The events of 2011 in the Middle East, which go by the name of the Arab Spring, could end up, if we don't do the right thing with regard to Syria, providing a near-perfect lesson as to which regional alliance is worth aligning with. Yeah? Pro-Western Hosni Mubarak, a faithful, for whatever else he was, not democratic, you know, a faithful servant, so to speak, of the Western strategic arrangement in the Middle East, was abandoned and fell. Pro-Iranian Syria, on the other hand, if it turns out the way it looks like it may do, will have dug in, and with the energetic help of its regional patron, will have survived and prevailed. This is precisely the outcome which we should fear, and which we should be looking in any ways necessary or any ways possible to prevent. However, let me conclude with a not entirely optimistic note. It seems to me that in order for the West to begin to develop the kind of policies necessary to begin to roll back, so to speak, Bashar Assad's resurgence and recovery, would require a clarity of vision and a decisiveness with regard to the Middle East, which I'm afraid has mainly been notable by its absence in the recent period. Bashar Assad, as a result, absent that change of mood in the West, is probably safe. on condition that he can see out the current internal descent, and it looks like he probably will be able to, he faces no real danger to his rule. The implications for his survival will be profound and will be wholly negative for the West and for its remaining regional allies. And on that happy note, I will conclude, and I'll be very happy to take your questions and comments. Thank you very much. Yes.
Thank you. I have two questions, quite different ones. The first one is, what is going on inside Syria with the Syrian economy, and how is that affecting the turmoil in Syria, number one. Mm-hmm. And number two, I'd like very much if you would be willing to elaborate on the last subject that you touched, and that is the Western, primarily the U.S., interpretation of the events and their silence.
Mm. Okay. With regard to the economy, the Syrian economy is in dreadful straits. The country has few natural resources. It had a little bit of oil. That's running out. There was reverse growth last year of 3%, minus 3% of the economy last year. The economy is mainly dependent on donations from outside and on tourism. Tourism was the sector they were most optimistic about. Of course, that sector, you can imagine, except for journalists pretending to be tourists, is down since the last couple of months. So they are really in dreadful straits. They are dependent, as are the Egyptians dependent, on support, in essence, from outside. This is not a regime which is capable of supporting itself. This is important because throughout the Arab world, and in Syria no less than elsewhere, the real meaning of these uprisings or of this discontent is that these countries, and this goes for pro-Western and anti-Western Arab countries, have succeeded in producing large numbers of and educating large numbers of young people for whom they simply do not have the economic infrastructure to then employ and give productive lives to. There is a massive superfluous group of educated young people in Arab country after Arab country, and it is these young people whose entry onto the political stage was in essence what these uprisings have been about. It doesn't mean that, you know, as some people would like to wax lyrical about it, it doesn't mean that then they take power and everything's fine. That's not what's happened, it's not what's going to happen. But these were the young people who were erupting onto the scene. So the Syrian uprising is really a story of Syrian economic failure. But having said that, as we know from examples elsewhere, a brutally cruel authoritarian regime can often stay in power in spite of the fact that it is entirely economically unsuccessful. If it just decides, I want to, I'm going to put enough money from foreign donations into my armed forces, and we're going to repress any attempt to get rid of us, this may sound crude, it's not a bad policy for survival if you're an authoritarian regime. It's done the North Koreans no harm, for example, over the last decades. And I suspect that it's most likely, at least, that the Syrians will be heading down this road too. There are those who say, yes, but surely that means in the long term the regime must be doomed. Surely it means that, yes, they can suppress this uprising, but it'll happen again somewhere down the line and somewhere again. The answer is yes, I think it probably will erupt again somewhere down the line. But it regrettably, history does not follow a simple deterministic pattern where just because a regime is lousy and has no moral right to exist, it will necessarily fall anytime soon. Perhaps in the long run, virtue will win in human affairs. I certainly hope so. But in the short term, these Syrians, in spite of the absolute catastrophic management of the economy, are quite likely to stay in power. With regard to your second question of the Western reading of these events, I have to say that I think that, and this goes not only for the US, but for the Europeans more so even, there just hasn't been a reading initially. You know, what the sense you get has been of absolute confusion coming out in the first weeks, you know, and of contradictory signals being given. First of all, Mubarak was not a dictator, if you remember Vice President Biden, and then all of a sudden he was dead and he had to go straight away, according to the President, you know, literally days later, you know. With regard to Tunisia, again, the initial assumption it'll go as far as Tunisia and then it won't go any further, and then it did, you know. And with Libya, again, I have to say from the point of view of this humble Israeli analyst, at least, I mean, the decision to make Libya the target, okay, these guys, you know, these ones we're not going to stand for. Very strange from my point of view. I mean, what is this Gaddafi regime actually, ladies and gentlemen? This is an isolated oddity. Yeah, he's a horrible leader. He's a nasty man, very bad man, yeah? But, you know, quite separate and isolated from the real threats in the region, the Iranians and their Islamist friends. This is an eccentric regime. This is the one we're going to send the air force against. I find it quite strange and hard to understand. My own sense has been there has been confusion on the part of the West and an inability to understand what's really going on, and therefore a sort of no strategy at all, a strategy of non-strategy, responding to events as they occur in ways which are quite contradictory to one another if you look over, you look at it over a period of months, you know, from the beginning in Tunisia up until today. That's my sense at least, and I don't have a sense that real clarity of thinking has emerged. Now, let me just add that what has emerged is a very simplistic picture of what's going on, which we find predominant in media analysis of the situation in the Middle East right now, which is that it's 1989 in the Middle East. Right? No one actually bothers to analyze it, it's that they assume it, and if enough people assume it, it kind of becomes in the air. Yeah? 1989 in the Middle East, you know, Syria is Poland, I don't know which, you know, Libya is the Czech Republic. Yeah? This sort of nonsense will get us nowhere. It's not, the pre-existing strategic challenges have not disappeared, but no less importantly, the civil societies and the norms and the levels of education which were required in Central Europe to ensure the successful transition to democracy that took place in 1989 are just not present in any Arab country. And the assumption that because you have demonstrations in the street and Facebook and Twitter, you therefore will have a speedy transition to democratization is just not happening. I would suspect, and I'll conclude on this and we can have more questions, I don't want to go on and on, but I will, I would suspect that we could well look back on this Arab Spring of 2011 and say that its main and most important historical outcome was the loss of Egypt to the West. This actually could well be the only thing which 10 years from now is remembered about this, if we play this wrong. And this seems to me to be the real kind of things we should be focusing on. Yes, please.
Thank you.
Yeah. From your own analysis, couldn't one say that the Western countries, by and large, have taken the less courageous, less dangerous approach to dealing with these different Arab revolts? In other words, precisely because Egypt and Tunisia represented Western-oriented countries, and Gaddafi's regime represents an anomaly that's way out, you know, in left field, they have avoided a situation like dealing with Syria, which really does pose a challenge to the rising power in the Middle East. Mm. So to what extent could a kind of crypto-appeasement be a factor in this?
I think it's a very good way of looking at it. I think we have to differentiate here between the US administration here and the Europeans. I think with regard to the EU, there is a kind of knee-jerk appeasement. That's kind of the default position. So that there is no strong strategic orientation of any kind on the part of the EU countries with regards to the Middle East. They will trade with anybody, more or less, and they will do their best to profit from that. And that's pretty much as far as I think the thinking goes nowadays. So they were very, very happy to trade with the Syrians and with the Libyans up until the point where it became no longer tenable to openly do so, and then they drew back. And if Assad survives, I have very little doubt whatsoever that he'll be back. He will be welcome in Sarkozy's Paris or Cameron's London within a few months, just as long as enough time for the smoke to die down. With regard to the US administration, I think that it's more complex. The results may end up being similar, and if the Americans are doing something, of course, it's more important, because they're the ones who actually can provide leadership if they wish to. The Obama administration, I think, set itself a very clear goal, maybe even its central foreign policy goal, which was the desire to repair America's relations with the Muslim world, as the president defined it then in his Cairo speech. And I think that a great deal of that remains. That's really where the emotion is, if there is such a thing, you know, with the Obama administration. That does not quite go easily hand in hand with, or easily translate into, you know, issuing a real and necessary challenge to dangerous forces within the Arab world. What you'll probably want to do, if that is the way you're thinking, is to finesse differences and to try to find some kind of modus vivendi with whoever happens to be strong, on the street, so to speak, on the stage. I have to say that I think there's an additional element to it with this administration. Here I'm getting into speculation, but take it for what it's worth. I think that there is a certain respect afforded by this administration, forces that look authentic or that can perceive to be, you know, these are the real guys. These aren't the kind of Western yuppie. You know, these are the real, you know, representative. I have a sense of a certain emotional attachment or inclination towards those, which equally prevents a harsh response being taken when it's needed.
That's a very shrewd comment.
So I think if we put all these things together, it starts to be apparent that our hopes for clarity, you know, and our hopes for a clear and cold-eyed assessment of who are the forces that threaten our interests as the West in the region, I'm afraid are not going to be coming along, in my estimation at least, anytime soon. Certainly not with the current EU leaderships, and I suspect also not with the current US leadership. Yes, please.
I understand this intellectual, whose name is Levy, from France, became interested in getting rid of Gaddafi and had influence with Sarkozy. So that's a pretty capricious reason to bomb Libya. Why couldn't he convince Sarkozy, who pulled in England and then pulled in America, we want NATO, we want the EU to be good NATO partners, so we were dragged in. Although we're doing a lousy job in Libya, in terms of what has happened, why the hell can't we get rid of the Syrian and Iranian problem? It's my understanding that Iran, with all the ballyhoo, is a weak military power.
The Iranians, look, it's a good, with regard to the Iranian supposed weakness, this is an interesting thing which is perhaps worth, you know, worth developing, and so thanks for the question. Yeah, the Iranian conventional military forces are not strong. The Iranian conventional military forces would not last very long in a frontal war against the United States armed forces, of course, or even some regional armed forces. That's not really the problem, though. The problem is that whilst the conventional armed forces of Islamic Republic of Iran may be relatively weak and poorly developed, the Iranians may not be good at much, but one thing which they have proven to be truly world-class in is the effective use of proxy military forces as a tool for building political influence. That might sound like a bit of a mouthful, but if we put it into real terms, it becomes immediately apparent what I'm talking about. Hezbollah represents a 30-year investment on the part of the Islamic Republic of Iran to develop a proxy military force in Lebanon. That proxy military political force now dominates Lebanon. The Iranians are sponsoring the Muqtada al-Sadr organization in Iraq, which was ended up being the key factor in deciding whether Maliki could form a government in Iraq or not after the protracted negotiations of the elections of 2009. The Iranians promote Hamas, have taken on Hamas as a client, and by doing so, have, as we are now seeing, given themselves the power of veto over any progress possible between Israelis and Palestinians, etc., etc. So the answer is yes. If it comes to conventional military force, you are correct. This is not a strong country. But it is a country that has developed a strategy which right now means that you cannot get anything done in any important part of the Middle East without coming up against an Iranian client or proxy who can make your strategy not work if it chooses to do so.
But they're not as strong as Hitler.
They're not as strong as Hitler. This is true. This we can say with Hitler. They're not as strong as Hitler. But in terms of the Middle East region, they are playing a very powerful negative role. The point I want to make to conclude this is the following, back to our earlier question. If you want to manage the Middle East, and wherever you try to manage, you come up against an Iranian proxy organization, you have one of two choices, don't you? You can either go for confrontation, or you can go for keeping things quiet and doing business one way or another. Right now, we in the West are choosing not to rock the boat. The West does not want an open confrontation with the Iran-led regional bloc. I think we are going to pay a price for that in the future, but that's where we are at. And just finally, you said about Henri Levy and the Libyans. Yeah, I mean, one hears this. Of course, it's impossible to really know what are the internal, you know, does Sarkozy really take a call from Bernard Henri Levy and decide policy? Well, I really hope not. If that's the case, we're in big trouble. But, you know, we are told that there are people who have influence. Henri Levy was one mentioned. Samantha Power was in this country. In this country was mentioned. There's also somebody who was very much in favour of the notion of human rights, of you know, of social work, foreign policy as a form of human rights advocacy, or foreign policy as a form of social work. It leads to strategic anomalies, I think, and it leads to a great deal of resources and even lives being wasted carrying out or promoting policies without great logic to them. Yes, please.
Two-part question. First is, what percent of the Syrian military are conscripts? Could you answer that?
Oh yeah, 35%.
35%.
Yeah.
Okay. The other thing is just very pie in the sky, but you know, the motto in the Middle East is the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Mm-hmm. Is there any chance that these conscripts, the people on the street in Syria, can see that their enemy is Assad? Israel is the enemy of Assad. Is there any way Israel can subtly play a positive role to get rid of these bad, you know, guys like Assad and allow the Arab Spring to spring?
Yes, that'd be good. Let me tell you the funny thing. We often hear the Assad regime described as an Alawi regime, and then we are told that, well, you know, 70 or 75% of Syrians are Sunni Muslims. So surely there must be a way to leverage that, right? There must be a way to leverage the fact that so much of the population seems to be excluded from engagement or involvement in the regime. The problem is that it's not as simple as that, because the Assad regime does not depend solely on support of Alawis. What the Assad regime has managed to do is to co-opt considerable numbers of Sunni Syrians too. So let's take a moment to consider this, and I'm happy to be asked this question. First of all, let's not forget that between 10 and 15% of Syrian Sunnis are in any case Kurdish Syrians. Now, of course, they're very anti the regime, but they're a little bit separate from the whole Arabic-speaking political culture of Syria. But more importantly, there is a Syrian business class based on the city of Aleppo, which, whilst it will undoubtedly have no political sympathy for the Assads at all, has essentially been given a sort of quid pro quo by the regime, which is, okay, you can conduct business, you can carry on your commercial activities, leave politics and the military to us. There is a great fear in the Arab world of what in Arabic is called fitna, it means chaos. And in a certain sense, the Assads have been able to buy, not the loyalty, but at least the quiescence of large parts of the Sunni commercial class by saying, you know, with us at least you don't have chaos. You can, you know, your wife comes home in the evening, she's safe, your kids can walk on the street, and these kind of, which can't be assumed throughout the Arab world, the Assads can kind of give that, and I think that maybe explains to some degree why Aleppo, for example, has been so quiet. The crucial Sunni Arab city of Aleppo has been quiet. Secondly, even with regard to the military and security forces, we hear so much about the Alawi-dominated military and security forces of Syria. Let me tell you, there are Sunnis also holding high and important rank in the Syrian military and security forces. Let me take a moment and take an example of this. I talked about the Syrian intelligence services, Syrian security services, and I said there's four main services. One is military intelligence, the other is Air Force intelligence, the other is political security, another one's called state security. Of these, and this, if we look at how this works, we can maybe get a sense of why it's not as simple as the Sunnis are down and the Alawis are up. Of these four intelligence organizations, two are headed by Alawi Syrians, and two are headed by Sunni Syrians. Okay, the military intelligence and Air Force intelligence are headed by Alawi officers, and the other ones, political and state security, are headed by Sunnis. All four of these men answer to a guy called General Hisham Ikhtiar, who is an Alawi, and he reports directly to Assad. What do we understand by this structure? Clearly, the Alawis are on top. They're the ones who are, the president is an Alawi, he's on top, and the top guy, Ikhtiar, is an Alawi. But at the same time, you know, to be head of state security or head of political security, it's not nothing. You know, if you were, you know, you're head of that, and of course, if he's head of it, it means that his cousins and his family and everyone from his area are also benefiting from that high position. Those people also have a stake in the regime. Yeah, it's not that they're all on the streets and being slaughtered. Those Sunnis also have a stake in the regime. So the regime has managed to build up for itself a whole structure of clients and bought-in interests, which is largely Alawi, but not solely Alawi, which includes considerable amounts of the Sunnis too. So the hope that, look, statistically, so many of these guys are Sunnis, surely they must hate the regime, I'm afraid doesn't necessarily translate easily into reality. And let me just conclude by saying one extra point, which is not a nice point to have to make, but it's a fact, is that terror, if uncompromisingly applied, sometimes works, at least for a time. And from the point of view of the Sunnis who don't have a stake in the regime, the poor, conscripted, Sunni, under-equipped, underfed Sunni conscripts, they are kept in fear, and they are frightened. And if we think of that mass grave of 80 soldiers discovered in Dara, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago now, we can see that their fear is well-founded. Yes, please.
First, a quick comment. When you're talking about Sarkozy after 60 days welcoming back in, I think that the United Nations would be a lot tougher. I think it would be 90 days before they're allowed back on the Human Rights Council. So mark that. But I been reading a little bit about the weaponry that's being imported into Lebanon used by Hezbollah. In addition to it being Iranian, a lot of this is Russian-made weaponry. And nobody really has been talking too much about the Russians and their role in all of this, even though they're supposedly a member of the Quartet for Peace. They seem to really be working even militarily against Israel's interests. So if you have any, just if you could shed some light on it.
Absolutely. First of all, with regard to Syria, it's very direct. It's like I should have mentioned, so I'm glad you asked this. The Russians have been absolutely central in preventing any possibility of tough action against the Syrians via the UN. If it happens at all, it will have to happen not through the UN, because of course Russia is a Security Council member, and the Russians will not countenance any strong action against their very close ally and confidant, the Assad regime. Yeah, weaponry is certainly coming in. I mean, I can tell you without wishing to go into too much of a personal anecdotes and so on, but much of the weaponry which took quite a heavy toll of Israeli forces during the 2006 Lebanon war, and specifically against armor. Again, people here will be familiar that, you know, one of the main ways in which we lost soldiers in 2006 was through the use of anti-tank, quite sophisticated anti-tank systems against some of our armor on the part of Hezbollah. Well, this was Russian equipment. This was Cornets, Cornet missiles. And it comes from Russia. It comes with a Russian stamp. You don't get it from anywhere else. Yeah, so this is, the Russians, of course, absolutely, the Russians do what only you can only do if you're Russia, which is you show them the evidence, and they just go, yeah, well, that's not true. That's, we deny it. We deny everything. It's Russia, so you get away with doing that, right? You can do what you want. This is Russian stuff, Russian gear, which was used in 2006 to kill Israeli soldiers. It's absolutely clear. The evidence is absolutely unambiguous. So yes, sure, the Russians are a central armorer for the Syrians. This much is not in dispute. And a certain amount of that weaponry finds its way to paramilitary clients such as Hezbollah. Having said that, and it's important to be accurate here, you know, this Russian regime is a regime which is interested in power, in money, in influence. It's not ideological. You know, Putin and Medvedev are not ideologues. There's no ideological link between them and the Syrians anymore. There's certainly no ideological link between them and the Iranians, which does put a certain break, so to speak, at a certain point on their acting as an armorer to these regimes. The fact of the matter is that the Russian regime has a great deal to worry about in terms of radical Islam. It is no less opposed to radical Islam as are any of us, and it has much to worry about regarding the Northern Caucasus and elsewhere. As a result, and it doesn't want a nuclear Iran either, as a result of which we can see a pattern whereby sometimes when the Syrians and Iranians go to ask for really game-changing weapons systems in Moscow, they come home empty-handed. And a good example of this, again, many people are probably familiar with, is the S-300 air defense system, which the, first of all, the Syrians asked for, and I think the Russians just sort of fell about laughing, so we're certainly not giving it to you, get out of here, you know. But then the Iranians went to ask for it, and there was a strong sense that the Iranians just might get it, and if they had got that system, one of the most advanced air defense systems available on the market today, it would have made the possibility of military action against Iranian nuclear facilities exponentially more complex, if not inconceivable. The Russians did not give them that. Now there are, it's a complex story, which again some here perhaps know, but it is also related to the administration's decision with regard to the missile defense shield in Central Europe, and so there was a whole quid pro quo going on, but bottom line from the point of view of us as Middle Easterners is the S-300 system didn't find its way to Tehran, which means that you can do business with the Russians to a certain degree on this. There is give and take, because they are not a crazy ideological regime arming ideological friends. They are troublemakers, and they want money. That's what it comes down to. And it's a problem, but it's not, it's not dealing with an ideological enemy. Yes, that's the best I can say, really, with regard to that.
If I could get a question, the name of your book is Transforming Fire.
Yes.
And the blurb is that there's a move from an Arab war to a broader Islamic war, if I understood it. You haven't really commented on that Islamic element in this entire regional piece or explanation.
It's very important. My colleague at the Jerusalem Post, Yaakov Katz, with another friend of ours, Yoaz Hendel, just released an excellent book, which I recommend everybody to read when it comes out in English, as it hasn't done yet, called the Israel-Iran Conflict. But I met Yaakov at a wedding the other week, and I said to him, listen, you shouldn't have called it. To call it the Israel-Iran Conflict is too narrow. I said, never mind. So what I call it, at least, is the Israel-Islamist Conflict. Why, in my view, is this a superior term for what we're dealing with right now? Because this is not only about a regime or a government, a state, with which we have a problem. The reason why the Iranians are able to cast their shadow so effectively across the region, in the way which we discussed earlier from an earlier question, and finance and arm and create proxy organizations, is because these proxy organizations are not consisting just of mercenaries paid by the Iranian state. That's not what they consist of. The Iranians take genuine and genuinely popular local Islamist movements and Islamist phenomena, and then they arm them and train them and give them the abilities which only a state backer can provide. And that's what makes the situation truly dangerous. So the top-down influence of Iran is crucial. But the existence on the bottom of thousands and thousands of young men across the Middle East willing to engage in these kind of organizations is no less crucial, which means that the fact that radical Islamic ideas remain the most powerful and popular tools for mobilization across the Arabic-speaking world is an absolutely crucial part of this picture. It's not just about the Iranian state interest, it is about the meeting of the Iranian state interest from above with genuine and popular Islamist phenomena from below. If we think of how this works in practice, we don't have to look very far. Think of Hezbollah in Lebanon, and we begin to, which is, remains the kind of the classic model of Iranian success so far, by far their greatest success. On the one hand, sure, it was 1,500 Revolutionary Guard officers or operatives who went to Baalbek in 1982 and began to put that organization together. But they didn't put it together out of whole cloth. They went down there because they knew there was a ferment underway at that time of young Shia Lebanese who were looking for leadership, who were looking for militancy. And it was the harnessing of that by the Iranian state interest which created that very potent and dangerous organization of Hezbollah. So yes, I think that what is taking place across the region is a very profound and profoundly important Islamization of regional politics. If elections were held freely, I used to say if, and of course they won't be, you can't say that anymore, right, because of the Arab Spring. Yeah? If free elections were held tomorrow in country after country of the Arabic-speaking world, the victors would be one or another version of Islamic politics. It is very possible that after September of this year, we will be dealing with an Egypt which is dominated by Islamism, or at least which is heavily influenced by Islamist political interests after the presidential and parliamentary elections due in September. Which means that this stuff hasn't just gone away because of the Arab Spring. It may well be about to get a huge shot in the arm because of the Arab Spring. So what all this means is that the very terms of Israel's conflict with its neighbors, in a certain sense, are undergoing change. Back in the 50s, Israel faced a coalition of supposedly secular Arab nationalist enemies committed to its destruction. Most of the story of the region regarding Israel since the late 70s has been the gradual winding down of that challenge as player after player left the arena. First of all, and most importantly, of course, Egypt. And then, problematically, but then we thought at least the PLO also and Jordan also and so on and so forth. That whole sense of our conflict slowly winding down is being to a great extent reversed right now. It's being reversed because of a new coalition of new ideologies and new states, not all of them Arab. Iran, of course, is not Arab, which have, in a sense, taken the old goal of Arab nationalism, namely the termination of Jewish sovereignty in the region west of the Jordan River, and made that their own banner, picked up that old banner and begun to wave it for themselves. So this is a new kind of conflict. It, in all sorts of ways, is taking up the goals of the older conflict, but it has new parameters, it involves new players, and the case against Israel is based overwhelmingly on an Islamist worldview, which remains the most powerful and mobilizable idea currently existing in the Arabic-speaking Middle East.
Question over here.
You take an Arab measure of things, who benefits.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make benefits very, very explicit, crystallize them for America. But they're not going to go to war for Israel. Certainly, this administration isn't going to do it. The UN certainly isn't going to do it. And Europe doesn't care. Don't back anybody to do business.
Mm-hmm.
So, what is there for America to get them off this fear of getting involved?
Let me tell you that this is. It's crucial, but it's not hard to answer this, because the real goal, the real strategic goal of Iran in the Middle East is not to do with the Mediterranean, and it's not to do with Israel. Israel and the Palestinian issue is a banner which the Iranians want to wave to give themselves as non-Arabs legitimacy amongst the Arabs. So in that sense, it's central. But the real concrete strategic goals of Iran are not directed towards the Mediterranean. They are directed southwards towards the Gulf. That is to say, towards the center of global oil supplies, which is the very reason why the United States is engaged with the Middle East in the first place. First and foremost, America is crucially concerned with the continued smooth flow of Gulf oil out of the Gulf at affordable prices for American and other consumers, not just American consumers, because the United States has become, in a sense, the world guarantor of stability and energy, of stable energy markets. The goal of the Iranians is to replace the United States as the key security guarantor in the Gulf. That would be real power for Iran. If Iran had the ability to set oil prices how it wanted to and to control that crucial part of the world, that would mean real power. That is Iran's neighborhood. Let's not forget the geography of it. Iran is on one side of the Gulf. Yeah, the Gulf is, the Saudis and the Gulf is on the other side. The Iranians call it the Persian Gulf. The other ones call it the Arab Gulf. But this is another thing. The Iranians are doing all they can to spread their influence into the Gulf. The uprising in Bahrain, which also was a part of the Arab Spring, which we haven't discussed yet today, formed an immensely important part of this for the Iranians. Bahrain has a Shia majority population. It therefore was a prime target for Iranian political / military subversion. And the Iranians thought that the Khalifa monarchy would fall and that a new client state for them, based on the Shia majority in Bahrain, would be born. And that would only be a stage in the game. Because the real prize from the Iranian point of view would be to spread the protests, spread the fire, down to the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, where there is a majority Shia population, and that is where the greater part of Saudi oil fields also are located. All this is not a threat to Israel. This is a direct threat to a crucial part of United States security policy, global security policy. Because Bahrain, apart from being much else, is also, of course, the headquarters of the United States Navy's Fifth Fleet. That is to say, the agency that keeps order and enables oil to keep on flowing outside of the Strait of Hormuz. The Iranians would like to replace the Americans in that job. They're doing their best to do so. Now, here's an interesting thing that just took place in Bahrain. In Bahrain, things didn't work out exactly as the Iranians had planned. But they didn't work out as the Iranians had planned, not because of the West, not because of the United States, which traditionally has been seen as the security guarantor of this of that region. What happened? Something very, a miracle of it, something very strange happened. Huh? The Saudis and the Gulfies actually got together and put together a military force called the Peninsula Shield. Now, it was only to fight against civilians, right? I mean, so, you know, not the Saudis, but even that, you know. Wonder of wonders, the Saudis actually getting up in the morning and doing their own security work. And doing it quite effectively and very brutally and cruelly, by the way, by keeping the Khalifa monarchy in power, because the Saudis understood what was at stake. But this is not good from a Western point of view. Because if the Saudis are that worried that they're actually going to start doing things for themselves, it means they have the very strong contention, the very strong feeling, suspicion, that their traditional guarantor, the United States of America, is not going to help them out. And that's not good. You want your clients to think you're going to help them when the chips are down. The Saudis apparently don't, to the extent of actually doing something for themselves. This is all crucial American security interests. This is about an Iranian direct challenge to a crucial part of America's economic and also strategic interests. We have to, I think, make the case again and again and again that the Iran-led regional bloc poses a direct threat to American economic and security interests in the Middle East, not only and not even primarily is it a threat to Israel and to Israel so well? Yes?
Well, I want to pick up on what you said, and I hope this doesn't sound like I'm veering off into some sort of weird conspiracy theory type of approach, but if you have an administration that is focused so strongly on developing alternative energy sources and seems to be extremely hesitant about allowing for traditional energy sources in this country to be exploited, is there a possibility that perhaps this administration does not see the strategic importance of the Gulf, or is it, am I veering off into something that's too bizarre?
I think it's a bit early to start drawing those kind of conclusions. Because even if you want to develop alternative sources of energy, which is, by the way, is a fine, you know, no problem, by all means do that. But I mean, for the, you know, any sane, sentient human being understands that for the interim period, let's say, you know, oil remains absolutely crucial.
But, you're pointing to this hesitancy to, you talked about the fact that it was the Saudis who ended up having to defend themselves rather than depending on their traditional guarantor. So my question then goes back to, well, why didn't the traditional guarantor get involved, put some skin in the game?
I think that the current U.S. administration is immensely concerned about not entering into a new war in the Muslim world. Now, that sounds like a funny thing to say, right? Because they're bombing the hell out of Libya right now. Yeah? But as we said before, you know, the Iranians and their friends is the real game. If you start to take them on, it's going to require an immense amount of effort and money and lives, very possibly.
Of course, it would be against the popular side. They don't want to be seen as being opposed to the people's movement.
Yeah, I think there may be an element of that as well. Although, having said that, even when, as in Iran in 2009, this administration could have portrayed itself as being on the side of the people's movement, as they, when they could have said, well, look, we're just standing for the people who've just had an election stolen from them, even then there seemed to be this immense reluctance to sort of to come out in favor of, you know, the people of Iran and against the regime. I think there is a real, it feels to me even like something visceral on the part of this administration, this absolute desire to avoid confrontation in that area if it can possibly be done so. And so I think as a result they are, they've taken their eye off the ball with regard to their interests being threatened. Let me tell you that with regard to the Saudis, it's not only to do with the Saudi action was not only or primarily to do just with events in the Gulf. The Saudis, by all accounts, and on this I speak to people who know what they're talking about, were absolutely furious and dismayed at the abandoning of President Hosni Mubarak of Egypt. For them, this was a real game changer. Because they just didn't get it. Yeah, the Saudis are not Democrats. Huh? I mean, the Saudis are a pretty disgusting bunch, actually, in most ways between us. Yeah, but they happen to be an important linchpin in all sorts of ways. Their view was, but we don't understand, this guy stuck by you for 30 years. You know, we thought that you had this client-patron relationship. We know about that. Clients and patrons is what we, the Saudis, do, yeah? And they just can't figure out that you threw the guy to the wolves like that because of some demonstration. They just don't get it. Now, you know,
I'm
not...
Too nice a guy.
Too nice a guy. There you go. Too nice. I mean, whatever one wants to think about the ethics of this and of authoritarian government, in any case, in terms of interests, the Saudis are deeply worried and deeply concerned by this, and I would think that it's not a good way to go down. So for this administration, it's not only about the Saudis themselves, it's also about, I would say, errors or at least judgment calls they've made more broadly in the region, which have led to this this very deep concern being felt by the Saudis and others in the Gulf.
Yeah. Look, I'd like to address first that why the United States is not more proactive with respect to the Middle East. The Soviet Union dissolved not because they lost on the battlefield, because at the time they were faced with near bankruptcy. Now, fortunately, they were saved late subsequently because of their petroleum and gas sources. But now we're faced with sort of a similar kind of situation. We're just finishing up a very long war in Iraq. We're finishing up with a war in Afghanistan. And there's a good chance, in my view at least, that when we pull out of Iraq, there's going to be a very bloody civil war. And when we pull out of Afghanistan, I think the enemy will come in back where they were. Mm-hmm. So we have spent a tremendous amount of money. We are faced with a very, very difficult dilemma with respect to finances in this country, and that's putting it mildly. So we really don't want to get involved with another war with Iran or anybody else in it. Now, naturally, if Israel were attacked, I'm sure that the United States would aid them to the nth degree. But I don't even think we wanted to become involved in Libya. But we were sort of dragged in by the NATO, and so instead of putting troops on the ground, boots on the ground, we bombed the hell out of them, and we will probably continue. It's the least expensive way to do it. So I think that's why we haven't become more proactive. We just can't afford it. We are in deep financial trouble in this country. Now my question to you. It appears to me in the Near East, and even in the Middle East, that the governments who are elected, or the people that we are that are elected to those governments to lead their nations, are not really the power in that country. It is usually the army, and in the case of Syria, the Ba'ath Party. So you may have an eye doctor in charge, allegedly in charge, in Syria, but he's told what to do, in my opinion. And the same thing, you have a similar situation next door to Afghanistan and Pakistan. You have a government that really is not in control. It's the intelligence organization and it's the army that's in control. In fact, we deal directly with the army on many issues in Pakistan rather than going through the government. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, let me say two things. First of all, with regard to the first thing that you said, look, I mean, of course, you are right in terms of the amount of money spent in Iraq and Afghanistan and the difficult financial straits that the Western world and the United States find itself in. This is, of course, correct. Okay, I understand. All I'm trying to say is that the cost of not stopping the Iranian advance in the region will be that the Iranian prediction, namely that they are the sunrise power in the region and that the United States and its allies are the sunset power, will be realized. That is, either they will be stopped, with all the difficulties inherent in that, which you correctly point to, but either they will be stopped or they will not be stopped. And if they are not stopped, then they will emerge as this very hostile, ambitious state will emerge as the dominant power in the region, facing off against what remains of, what will remain of, the former pro-Western security arrangement in the region. And states of the region will make arrangements as best they can. We are seeing already Saudi Arabia doing that with the Peninsula Shield. Israel will do its best too, and other states will do their best too. But I would suggest to you that in the long run, American and Western interests will suffer because Iranian ambitions will not be easily contained. They will either be contained by coercion or they will continue to expand to a point where they threaten all of us.
But they are under coercion right now.
Mm.
from the United States, and we have a tremendous, you know, the vast majority of the population of Iran is under 35 years old.
Yeah.
And they're very disgruntled. They are not in love with their government.
Yeah, right.
And, so, won't, okay. And, and what warfare tends to to occur today is propaganda. Not so much armed conflict, but propaganda. And if we can in some way incite that young majority who is anti-government, this would be the way, rather than send troops.
Let me, first of all, I'm not advocating that you send troops into Iran. This is not the point at all, and I wish to say that. But let me just say, in terms of the hope which I share that the regime can be brought down, I think it is quite unlikely for quite a long period to come.
Because
the regime itself wants to stay in power, just like in Syria. The regime itself wants to stay in power a little bit more, unfortunately, than the people who would like to bring them down want to bring them down. What I mean by that is that the regime is quite prepared to bathe its own streets in blood in order to stay in power. And the oppositionists, many of whom are friends, I know many good, wonderful people from the Green Movement, but these are sane and normal people. These are sane and normal people who will send their kids to university in Harvard and in Yale and in London and in Oxford, not waste them on the streets against the Revolutionary Guards. That's all understandable, but it means the Revolutionary Guards and their friends are likely to stay in power. So let me just say, this is how I think things are likely to play out in Iran. I'd like to believe also that the people of Iran can come and sort of get us out of this mess. I don't personally, as an analyst, predict that. We'll see if I'm right or wrong, but that's certainly my estimation. With regard, I want to just answer the gentleman's question, because I know we've just been discussing his comments, so let me also try and answer your question. With regard to Pakistan, I won't go into it because others around this table probably have greater expertise than I. Let me just say on Syria that I don't agree with your characterization. My own sense is that Bashar Assad and the Assad family are in control. And that the Ba'ath Party is really an empty shell to a great extent. They just have them there to get up and do that Soviet-style battling whenever they're asked to. You know, the real power there is the Assad family. There are those who say that actually his brother, Maher, and his brother-in-law, Asif Shaukat, are maybe a little bit more powerful than they're sometimes seen to be. But I think that President Bashar Assad is in control. I certainly haven't heard any really persuasive arguments to suggest otherwise. I think that he is a strong leader in his own way. Not necessarily the most competent, but certainly capable, as he's shown, of great brutality and cruelty. And again, going back to the Iranian thing we discussed a moment ago, sometimes that's enough, sadly. You know? Sometimes just the power and willingness to be brutal is enough to keep you in power. I think Bashar is in control. I think he wants to stay in control. And I think he's doing all he thinks necessary to stay in control. And he'll probably, at least in this round, prove victorious.